Americans know about the Boston Tea Party and the shot heard round the world, but 16 months divided these two iconic events, a period that has nearly been lost to history. Historian Ray Raphael's new book, The Spirit of 74, fills in the gap in our nation's founding narrative, showing how, in these mislaid months, step by step, real people made a revolution. After the Tea Party, Parliament not only shut down a port, but also revoked the sacred Massachusetts Charter. Completely disenfranchised citizens rose up as a body and cast off British rule everywhere except in Boston, where British forces were stationed. A Spirit of 74 initiated the American Revolution, much as the better-known Spirit of 76 sparked independence. It's a great pleasure to welcome historian Ray Raphael to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleased to be visiting in New England with you.
Very nice to have you here. How did you come to this project with your wife, Marie?
Well, I've been researching the American Revolution for 20 years, and the story that stands out in my mind is the revolution before the revolution, before Lexington and Concord, when all of Massachusetts and neighboring colonies supporting them shed British rule completely before Lexington and Concord. And I've been telling this story in various manifestations. And my wife, Marie, who's also a writer, said, hey, tell you what, why don't we really team up on a book that really makes this story accessible to the general public?
What do you feel is missing in the narrative? Because that 16 months, there isn't much written about that.
Yeah, well, yeah. Here's what the narrative looks like. There was the Tea Party, and London officials were very angry about that. Parliament decided to punish them. And they closed the port of Boston. And so other colonies then supported Boston and said, oh, you know, great sympathy, send them supplies. And they had a Continental Congress that petitioned the king saying, hey, maybe you could change this around. And then somehow 16 months after the Tea Party and a year after these harsh acts, the British march on two small towns in Massachusetts. And I'm looking at that narrative, and I say, what? What is going on? I don't see the connection. I don't see any causality. But that is in all the textbooks and all the standard narratives of the Revolution. So I'm looking deeper into this, and I see that there are these references to crowd actions and rural unrest in Massachusetts. And I find that the real grievance was, in addition to closing the Boston port, they yanked the whole Constitution away from the people of Massachusetts, their charter, which was their Constitution of 1691. So no longer could they meet in town meetings, which they had been doing forever. No longer would their elected representatives have any say whatsoever in the actual functioning of the government. The representatives would elect the all-powerful council, and now the council would be chosen directly by the crown, and all lower officials, they had no longer any say over their jurors, their sheriffs, anybody. So they were a subjected people. And when you think about it, what would we do today if our Constitution were absolutely yanked away and we had no say at all in our government? That, at last, would be probably what would unite the left and the right, and it certainly did unite the people of Massachusetts before Lexington and Concord. So the year before Lexington and Concord, these people got together and in very dramatic fashion completely overthrew all British rule, military and political. That's the story we tell in the Spirit of 74.
Talk a little bit about tea and how it was more than a commodity in the colonies. By the time the British began taxing it, you talk in the book about how it was itself a character in this drama in New England. How so?
Yeah, well, tea came to be a symbol, and the reason it got to be a symbol is because the Townsend Act taxed five items: lead, paint, paper, and I forgot the fifth one, and tea. But anyway, the main thing is the tea, and because they rescinded the taxes on the rest, and they kept the tax on tea. So tea became synonymous with tax. And so, you know, there was a lot of kind of culture built around that. When people were trying to resist British policy, they would boycott the tea, they would drink sassafras and other homemade, substitutes, and it became a character in its own right. And then when the Crown decided to support the failing, too big to fail East India Company by dumping its surplus, actually the Tea Act did not raise the tax on tea. It lowered the tax on tea for the giant corporation so they could undercut the smugglers. And so that's what they did. So the real uproar was really at that point not about taxes, but about the monopolistic control and the union of big state and big corporations undercutting the smugglers and the local merchants. So, yeah, tea was a character in its own right, and that's what triggered this massive revolution, not so much that the Tea Party itself, but the repression after the Tea Party when they yanked the Constitution away.
Boston, of course, part of this story, but also so many parts of our region, Worcester, Springfield, Great Barrington. How did these locales play such a front and center part in the story?
Yeah, Boston, you know, when this happened, they said, here's what we will do. Let's have another boycott. They call it a solemn league and covenant because they had done that in the past with the previous taxes. But they didn't think of what would make a more powerful impact, which was to shut down the government. And so that idea came from the counties, the western counties of Berkshire, Hampshire, and Worcester. And so what happened is each time the county courts would meet, and the county courts there were more than just courts. They were the administrative arm of government as well, and they were the farthest outreach of royal authority, basically. And so each time it was slated to meet after the Massachusetts Government Act, that's the one that shut down, that changed the charter. After that took effect, each time a court would meet, great numbers of people would come and make sure that it didn't. And these weren't just ordinary crowds, like in Worcester, where there were they had plenty of advance notice that they knew when the court was slated to meet. So on the appointed day, 4,622 militiamen. We have an actual head count. So, because one of the participants visited each of the 37 militia companies from 37 distinct townships all over Worcester County. So we're talking from up by the New Hampshire line to down by the Rhode Island line. And half the adult male population shows up on one day. And these are militiamen, well-coordinated, well-organized militia. And they line up in their companies and have the crown-appointed officials walk the gauntlet between them, each one had in his hand, and recite his recantation of the terrible, unjust, no good, unconstitutional acts of Parliament over 30 times as they walked this gauntlet between them. And that was the end. These militiamen seized political and military authority. And I say military because Gage had sent General Gage, who was the military governor of Massachusetts at that point. He had vowed to send troops to protect the court. And he got word that of this, what he would be facing, and he just said, no way, I can't do it. So that was the end of political authority in Worcester County and the end of military authority. And this is happening everywhere throughout Massachusetts. In Plymouth, the people get so pumped up after 4,000 people do the same thing in Plymouth that they gather around Plymouth Rock and they say, we're going to lift up Plymouth Rock and take it to the courthouse, downtown to the courthouse. And so they all gather around, and then the contemporary source that we have for this says, and finding it to weigh 10 tons at least, they left it where it was. So, these people had enough power to overthrow British rule, but they couldn't move Plymouth Rock. Let me emphasize, Joe, this is before Lexington and Concord.
Right.
And how in the world can we understand what happened at Lexington and Concord without understanding the complete revolution that came before it? And suddenly, now that there's a complete revolution before it, we begin to get some sense of why the British had to march into the countryside and go after those stores that they had, those military stores and provisions, because they were ready to defend this revolution. They spent the next several months getting ready, and they had provisions and arms for an army of 15,000 people. And before Lexington and Concord, 2 weeks before, they actually send out letters, and they're going to get 3,000 people from New Hampshire and 3,000 people from Connecticut, 2,000 from Rhode Island, the rest of Massachusetts. And they're all going to gather, and they're going to gather in Worcester, because that is kind of the heart of New England geographically and the heart of the resistance, not in Boston. They're going to gather in Worcester. and they're going to be ready to march against the British. And this is, again, before Lexington and Concord.
The book is fascinating. It is The Spirit of 74, How the American Revolution Began. It is published by the New Press. Ray Raphael, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure.
Thank you. I love talking revolution to the people of New England because that's where it happened.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Ray. Okay, again, the title of the book is The Spirit of 74, How the American Revolution Began. It's published by the New Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.